Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court.
Good morning.
My name is Ryan V. I represent the plaintiff, Tony
Nelson. Could you pull the mic up closer?
Oh, sure.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Ryan V. And I represent the plaintiff, appellant Tony Nelson. Judge Browning abused his discretion when he reversed the judgment based on Rule 59E when that rule was not available. And we ask that this Court reverse Judge Browning's decision and reinstate Judge Black's judgment along with all of his extant orders. I think the Court can do that for three reasons under Rule 59E, and as both parties have seemed to agree, the Court doesn't need to address the issue of qualified immunity. The first reason under 59, that Judge Browning abused his discretion is that this was a successive motion. And the case law is very clear that a successive motion to reconsider, whether it's Rule 59E or some other basis, is inappropriate.
Well, had they not filed that motion, wouldn't there have been a problem, a question at least, of whether or not appellate review would be possible?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there would have been if neither side chose to file a notice of appeal. You see, they filed that motion within the time period that they still had to file their notice of appeal, because the time that told it was the first motion, the first Rule 59E motion. And that 30-day period was still running when the city filed its, what we call the third motion, or perhaps it's the second motion. And so that second motion or third motion did not toll the time to appeal. So the city had to, essentially, to properly preserve its appellate rights, file a notice of appeal and file this second or third motion to reconsider, which is why a successive motion is inappropriate, because of what it does to the finality of judgments.
You said they did or did not have to do this to protect their appellate rights.
They did not. What they needed to do was file a notice of appeal. And the only reason that they can be here today is, of course, because Judge Browning reversed Judge Black. The plaintiff filed a notice of appeal. Had Judge Browning upheld the Judge Black's decision, the city would have been without jurisdiction to appeal because they didn't file a notice of appeal within the proper time period. There doesn't seem to be any dispute that only the first Rule 59E motion would toll the time. And this is clearly the second, according to the city, or the third, according to the plaintiff, and thus they've lost their opportunity to appeal.
Could I just ask a question about first, second, third, or second, third?
Yeah.
So let me make sure, tell me if I've got this wrong. As far as the defendants are concerned, the first one was filed May 7, 2012.
That's right.
Okay. And then they followed up with something on June 1, 2012. They called it a 60B, but the court denied it, calling it a 59E. But in any event, the judgment for the case was entered after that, July 5, 2012. And it was after that that the defendants filed the 50B that Judge Browning converted into the 59E. So here's my question. Wasn't that 50B, which was converted to 59E, the first and really the only post-judgment 59E motion?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so.
I said post-judgment.
Yes, I think it wasn't filed after the judgment, yes.
But so how is it a success? Isn't a 59E motion a post-judgment motion? I mean, by its very terms, it's a motion to alter or amend a judgment.
That's right.
And so how is it a successive 59E motion if this is the only one that was filed after the judgment?
Because I think the first one would be considered premature, but would still count as the first Rule 59E motion. We didn't find any Tenth Circuit case law, but the Seventh Circuit and some others have addressed this, that even if you file it prematurely, the court can address it, but that's your first Rule 59E motion. And then if judgment is entered and a second 59E then it's really your second. And so I think the court can consider it as premature. The other issue that I think the court has to look at, following that chronology, Judge Matheson, is that the advisory notes talk about whether Rule 59E is even applicable to a 50B judgment. So when Judge Black entered that 50B judgment, that would have been July 5th, 2012.
You know, I noticed that in the advisory notes, but did you argue that anywhere?
Well, I think we talked about it both in the brief in chief and in the reply.
Did you argue the advisory note in your briefs explicitly?
It's certainly discussed explicitly in the brief in chief in the footnote.
Okay.
And in the reply brief, it's discussed about whether this would even be allowed because of the advisory note. But I think that I struggled with that a little bit, too, because you could imagine a situation where a court entered a Rule 50B judgment, and then when you talk about manifest necessity, perhaps the court realized that there was some manifest error, clear error of law, and then does that advisory note really preclude the court from fixing that when you have a true situation of clear error or manifest injustice? And I don't know. I think the answer is not clear. It's a 1946 advisory note, and there isn't a lot of cases such as this where a court has altered or amended a Rule 50B judgment contrary to that note. But I think that would be a situation where, as we've argued, it meets the other requirements of 59E, and perhaps it's not styled under 59E, but the other requirements which weren't present here, aside from it being a successive motion, is that a 59E motion or a motion to reconsider can't bring up issues that have already been litigated or could have been raised earlier but weren't. And that is what the city's final 59E motion, the one Judge Browning granted, did. It brought up issues that had already been litigated, and it brought up a new issue that could have been brought up earlier but wasn't. It was essentially waived.
Let's say there's no there's not a successive 59E motion, and as you pointed out, by definition, 59E is supposed to occur post-judgment. If Judge Black hadn't retired and the case hadn't been transferred, could he have fixed his error? Assuming that it was an error, could he have said, "Oop, you know, I denied Rule 59E, or I granted this Rule 59E motion. I shouldn't have." Let's say it was the day after. Could he have fixed it, sua sponte?
That's a tougher question, Your Honor. I think that the answer is yes, if it meets that manifest injustice or clear error standard, and it was sua sponte, and we deal with the advisory note.
Well, isn't that exactly what your adversary's argument is? I won't say that your adversary's argument, that was Judge Browning's rationale, was that, well, I am standing in the shoes of Judge Black. Judge Black, or a successor judge, shouldn't be chained to an inaccuracy, regardless of whether or not what Town of Paraclete says. And so he, Judge Browning, if he can sua sponte correct it in the event of manifest necessity, why is Town of Paraclete a barrier to him fixing his own error?
Well, I think that's the part that I struggle with, Your Honor, but I think that the reason it's a barrier in this case is because there wasn't manifest error, or manifest injustice or clear error. I think that has to be present for the court to reconsider the judgment in this case. And
so we're down to looking at whether or not Judge Black's ruling was clear error, manifest injustice, wrong in some legal way, aren't we?
Well, I think that
when all of this melts away, that's really the question.
Well, I think that's one of the questions, Your Honor, but I don't think you have to get there if you decide that this Judge Browning should have denied the motion because it was successive or because it was arguing issues already litigated.
But I thought you had just told Judge Bacharach that had Judge Black stayed with the case, he could have ruled on such a motion.
Well, I think
I don't understand why changing the judges that are assigned to the case suddenly bars the second judge from doing what the first judge could have done.
I don't think that does, Your Honor, and I understood Judge Bacharach's question to be could Judge Black have done it sua sponte rather than pursuant to a motion, and so I think sua sponte is a more difficult question, but we don't have that question here. We have it pursuant to a motion, and so I think
well,
that,
but didn't Judge Browning sua sponte change the flavor of this motion?
Well, he converted it from Rule 50B to 59E.
Correct.
And as we argue in the reply, the law was clear long before the city filed their motion that when you file an improper 50B, the court can convert it to a 59E, so that essentially it was a disguise, or the city should have known, just like Judge Browning should have known, that just because you don't say 59E, that you say something else, that the court can then convert it. And that's the concern that the plaintiff has if the court were to allow this to stand, is that all you have to do is file something that doesn't say 59E and cross your fingers that the judge converts it to 59E, because that's what the law says the judge should do, and then grant your relief. Mm-hmm. But I think that turning to the question of what constitutes manifest injustice or clear error under 59E is important here, because that sets a limit, if you will, on the judge's discretion when they can reverse a judgment. And again, we're assuming they can do that to Rule 50B despite the advisory committee note.
Counsel, could I just parse your answer to Judge Briscoe? It seemed, in addition to the manifest injustice question, were you also saying maybe you don't even have to get there because these were issues that had previously been raised or should have previously been raised, and that in a way the defendants had waived their opportunity to have their 59E considered? Is that, are you making that argument?
Yes, Your Honor, I think I am. And I think it's, you look at it a little bit different when you look at the two bases, right? So the first basis is the 50B judgment grant by Judge Black. And then the second basis for Judge Browning was qualified immunity. And so if you look at qualified immunity, the clearly establishment prong is what Judge Browning relied on, and that was waived. So the question then is, can there ever be clear error or manifest injustice to essentially revive, whether it's sua sponte or whether it's pursuant to a disguised 59E motion, an argument that a party has waived? And I think the answer is no. That can't be the basis.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong on this. It seemed that Judge Browning said that they may have waived the qualified immunity argument if it were a 50B motion argument, but he went ahead and considered it once he converted to 59E. Am I correctly at least describing Judge Browning's opinion?
I think so, Your Honor, but I think that if we go back and look at how they waived, and they waived because they didn't raise it in Rule 50A at the close of the plaintiff's evidence, and the case law says you have to bring it up in Rule 50A. What the city did at Rule 50A was say we reassert our arguments in summary judgment, but they hadn't raised it on summary judgment. And so they had the duty and the burden to raise the clearly established prong at 50A. And then if Judge Black did what he ultimately did, to preserve that in their first motion to reconsider, they have to raise it again.
Wait, did you say they didn't raise it at summary judgment?
They did not at summary judgment or at 50A.
Didn't the district court address it, though, in denying summary judgment?
Well, I think that it gets briefly passed upon, but Judge Browning, when he analyzed that, you know, essentially said that the parties did not properly raise this issue and the court did not actually rule upon it. And so I think that argument, as Judge Browning found, was waived. And the city did not appeal Judge Browning's decision that it was waived. So the only question then before the court is, can a judge revive a waived, clearly establishment defense under Rule 59E? Is that clear error? Is that manifest injustice? And the problem with that is, if a party had appealed, then in theory the judge could do that while the appeal is in process, right? If we allow this second successive motion or third successive motion, it's going to then create judicial chaos when another party appeals and or appeals to preserve their right to appeal, and then the judge decides, well, it's clear error to save a waived, clearly established argument, so I'm going to rule on it. Well, that could change the entire course of the appeal. And, Your Honors, with the last few seconds, I would just ask the court, if it addresses qualified immunity, to look at the briefs, and we've argued that the law was clearly established, both under the obviousness prong as well as existing case law.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
My name is David Roman, and I represent the city of Albuquerque and the individual officers. For all of its procedural complexities, the question in this case is actually relatively simple, and I think your honors have kind of touched on it in your initial questioning. Does a successor trial court judge have the authority to address what he or she believes to be clear error by a predecessor judge as long as he continues to have jurisdiction to address post-judgment motions? Or is he instead bound to sign off on a judgment that he believes to be legally erroneous and contrary to the law simply because the previous court had denied a motion to reconsider?
Do you think Judge Black did have the power to sua sponte modify his grant of the 59E motion?
Absolutely, Judge Beckert.
How long then does that power, let's say Judge Black decides 2 months after the fact to fix it?
It has to be within the time that the court retains jurisdiction over any post-judgment motion that is filed. And so once the final judgment is ordered, the other side would have 28 days to file a post-judgment motion challenging that judgment or to file a notice of appeal. As long as that time period is still running, the court retains jurisdiction, and the case law is very clear that as long as the court retains jurisdiction, it can always revisit a decision that it has previously made, whether sua sponte or on motion. And I'd like to address Judge Briscoe's question that she raised earlier about whether this Rule 50B motion was something that had to be filed in order to preserve the right to appeal or not. Under the case law, the Supreme Court case law in place at the time, this was back in 2011, the case of Ortiz v. Jordan specified that if you raised an issue in Rule 50A and you did not file a Rule 50B motion, you had waived the right on appeal to address that. I know that the Elm Ridge case came along in 2013 in the Tenth Circuit that talked about whether it was necessary to file a Rule 50B motion if you've already filed a 50E motion. Could that preserve your right to appeal? At that point, the Tenth Circuit, even 2 years after this case, said it's not clear whether you could waive your right to appeal a 50A decision if you didn't file a 50B motion. So this is a motion that was filed out of an abundance of caution, not some sham motion to try to get a second 59E. In fact, in talking to trial counsel, they were quite surprised that it was converted to a 59E motion. They thought it was probably going to be denied quickly, and then the notice of appeal would be filed at that point. But as Judge Browning said, when talking about 59E motions, and I know Servants of the Paraclete is the case that generally defines how the Tenth Circuit handles 59E motions, I appreciated what he said when he said Servants of the Paraclete does not chain a district judge to an erroneous legal conclusion as long as he still maintains jurisdiction over the case. And I think it's really important to look at the context in which this arose. Not only did the defendants move for summary judgment on the basis of qualified immunity early in the case and have that denied both because of factual issues remaining and because the court said that the law was clearly established at a very high level of generality, but they also moved at the close of plaintiff's case and at the close of all the evidence for judgment as a matter of law under Rule 50A on both sufficiency of the evidence concerns and on qualified immunity. And at the close of evidence, the plaintiff also moved for judgment as a matter of law under Rule 50. At that time, Judge Black said, and I want to get this quote correct, he denied it because factual issues still existed. And he said, I think both of these motions turn on the interpretation of the facts that the experts used. Obviously, there's a discrepancy as to what happened at the scene. I'll therefore deny those and submit the matter to the jury. After a six-day bench trial, the jury came back and ruled in favor of all defendants on all counts. That should have been the end of the story. But following that jury determination, plaintiff moved to overturn the judgment by filing his own Rule 50B motion. And even though no facts had changed since the... Your Honor?
I wanted to let you finish.
Even though no facts had changed since the case had been given to the jury as a result of factual disputes, even though no new case law had come out in the interim, and even though there was no suggestion of malfeasance by any attorneys or jurors to call the verdict into question, Judge Black still overturned the verdict and overturned the will of the jury, entering judgment in favor of the plaintiff.
Let's say Judge Black was wrong. I want to get back to this servants of Paraclete issue. How do you deal, I understand how you deal with servants of Paraclete, how do you deal with the Exxon shipping case, which seems to have, where the Supreme Court used somewhat broader language, that Rule 59E permits a court to alter or amend a judgment, but it may not be used to relitigate old matters or raise arguments or present evidence that could have been raised prior to the judgment. So under that language, as I read it, the Supreme Court seems to be saying that if the judge is acting pursuant to a motion, he's not acting sua sponte, that it may not be used, passive tense, by anyone, including the judge, to relitigate old matters. Am I misreading Exxon shipping?
I would take issue with the final point that you made of no one, including the judge, may then use 59E to address what seemed to be as clear error. I agree that it's a prohibition on the parties of seeking to relitigate issues that have already been litigated or that should have been litigated, which is why the defendants didn't file a second 59E motion. They filed, as I said, this Rule 50B motion out of an abundance of caution to preserve the ability to appeal. But when Judge Browning got that case, he's left with a situation of feeling that a case that is going to be going out under his name and a judgment that is under his name is legally incorrect. And when you talk about could a judge sua sponte correct an error, I think that by converting this valid, timely 50B motion to one under 59E sua sponte, that Judge Browning was essentially acting sua sponte.
Well, let me play devil's advocate with that. The Yost case says that it was a Rule 59E motion. If the movement was in fact seeking to alter or amend a judgment, it doesn't matter if he called it a Rule 12 motion. It was a Rule 59E motion under the Yost case, correct?
Correct. There's no question that a judge, that the nomenclature of a motion is not definitive at all.
And so, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead. Take your point.
So anyway, the question I want to get to is, so when Judge Browning was acting, he wasn't purporting to act sua sponte. He was purporting to act as granting the Rule 59E motion, converted or not. He didn't purport to say, I'm going to sua sponte, fix Judge my predecessor's error. I Judge Browning, am granting this Rule 59E motion, right?
Well, in a sense, yes, but in a sense, no. Because if you go through that full 99-page opinion, there's a lot there. But he was doing a lot of foreshadowing at the beginning of, I found that Judge Black committed clear error when he reversed this, and also when he didn't address the qualified immunity at the proper level of specificity. I know that he committed clear error. However, 50B explicitly said 50B does not give me what I need, does not give me the vehicle I need to be able to do this. Therefore, I'm going to convert it to a Rule 59e motion, which I can do because it is in the nature of that. And it's only because he's seeking to correct that error that he's converting that motion. He could have easily said, this is in the nature of a 59e motion, and therefore I'm not even going to consider it because it brings up things that have already been litigated. But in my reading of it, he made clear that he was converting it in order to have a vehicle to correct what he saw as clear error.
And so it's not successive, that argument. What do we do with that argument?
That it's a successive 59E motion?
Right.
I would say that because it was done sua sponte, that it can't be seen as a successive Rule 59E motion. If you think about what the consequences...
Because it's the court acting and not the party filing a motion specifically delineating that rule.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
It's the court acting sua sponte. It's not the party filing a motion that delineates that rule.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. If you think about the practical consequences of calling it a successive Rule 59E motion, as opposing counsel had alluded to, the time to appeal begins to run at the time of the final judgment. Had this Rule 50B motion that was filed in order to preserve the right to appeal been converted to a 59E motion and it was said, too bad, it's a 59E motion, not a 50B, you no longer have the right to appeal because you waived that because you didn't file a 50B motion. You filed 59E, then you are left with a defendant who loses the ability to appeal an issue who did everything right in filing this motion to preserve that, but that right is taken away because of what the judge sua sponte did. That can't be. Am I not being clear about how that would leave them without a right? Because essentially, if they file a 50B motion,
can
as
I
they did, go ahead,
just
John.
Ask you a question to make
yes.
sure you are being clear. Is it correct to say, based on what you said up to this point, that if Judge Browning was acting sua sponte, then the 59E consideration was proper? But if Judge Browning was acting because the party caused him to act, then he did not properly... It was not proper for him to proceed and address the merits. Seems like that's where you are, but I want to make sure that's correct.
Thanks for allowing me to clarify, because I don't believe that's exactly the situation. If Judge Browning had come in and taken over the case and reviewed the full record on his own to be sure that he's comfortable with what his predecessor did and had acted in that way, I think we all agree that that would have been acceptable. I think the fact that he reviewed the full record and was perhaps spurred to do so by this motion, he still had the jurisdiction and retained jurisdiction for that 28 days after that jurisdiction existed because of the filing of the motion, which told the time for appeal. And I understand what you're saying, that had the 30 days expired or the 28 days expired, that jurisdiction would have gone from the district court.
Could you address the advisory committee note issue?
I don't read it in the same way as opposing counsel does, as preventing judges themselves from addressing what they see to be as legal errors. I view it as much more of as aimed at litigants themselves. And as we've discussed in the briefing, neither side has come forward with any case law in which a judge has been found to have abused his discretion by ruling on a Rule 59E motion that is either successive or that raises issues that have previously been litigated. If that rule were aimed at courts as well as at litigants, surely there would have been some instance in which a court would have been admonished or overruled for ruling on a 59E motion that was successive. But again, it provides judges a vehicle to easily say, this has already been litigated, we're not going to consider this for reasons of finality. But it does not tie the court's hands in the same way. And I understand that there's been an argument raised that there's essentially this whole parade of horribles, that if we allow this to happen, then there's not going to be finality on issues because people can file successive 59E motions that toll the time to appeal.
Well, you can file some motion under some rule, and the court will do what the court wants to do. I mean, there's that problem too, right?
Right. It's not.
I mean, the sua sponte thing always just makes my skin crawl. I've got to say that.
I understand, Your Honor.
I think litigants should be in charge of their cases, not judges. But anyway, that's aside.
I just want to close with saying that in this particular case, if you look at the briefing, I do believe it's clear that Judge Black did err by not putting the inferences in the light most favorable to the defendants, and by not even acknowledging, may I finish my answer, mm-hmm. Your Honor? I see I'm out of time.
Yes.
By not even acknowledging any of the expert testimony of defendant's expert, and by fully crediting the expert testimony of plaintiff's expert, who he had characterized, his qualifications he characterized as very weak. So I will stop with that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You have